I guess that was the operating philosophy for a lot of us for a long time. Don't worry, be happy, it'll fix itself. I'm not so sure what we've been hearing from our guest, Joseph Farrell, tonight in his book, Banksters, Babylon's Banksters, talking about physics, economics, Nazis, world conspiracies, cabals, suppressed technology. I know you folks have a lot of questions for him. We'll get right to the phones right after this on Coast to Coast AM. We're in our final hour with our guest, Joseph Farrell. His new book is called Babylon's Banksters, Going to the Phones, Wildcard Line, Bill in Staten Island. Good morning, Bill.
Good morning, George. First, let me congratulate you on having Joseph on tonight. If you get audited this year, we'll know why. I'd like to ask Joseph if, in his research, he'd come across the security guard, John Parker, and noted that he was a member of the Masons and he was the master mason of his temple, and that he had left his post that night when Lincoln was assassinated and actually met with John Wilkes Booth in the bar and had a drink. And then he went on a 3-day drunk, and he was never brought up on charges, and it was nothing ever noted about him. But he did receive a draft exemption from Mrs. Lincoln very, very mysteriously in 1863. And that draft exemption was sold to in an auction in 1982 for $4,000. Now, does Mr. Farrell have any information? And also that John Wilkes Booth was a member of the Knights of the Golden Circle. And when he was captured, he had a 60-pound draft note on a Canadian bank.
Well, in answer to your question, Bill, yes, I'm aware of those things. There actually was a scholarly study some years back, I forget the author's name, on the assassination of President Lincoln, and he goes into a lot of that. I do not talk about those details of the assassination in the book simply because there's already so much material in the book that it would kind of be a tangent to what I'm really after in the book. But yes, I'm aware of those things.
Thanks, Bill. Appreciate it. Wildcard line, Andy in L.A. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I have a clarification and a question. First, clarification on the Sanders Amendment to S-3217. That's the Dodd Federal Reserve Empowerment Act.
Uh-huh.
The Sanders Amendment is actually a partial audit, just for the emergency actions. The Vitter Amendment is actually a full audit, which is equivalent to S-604, which is the full audit, which is what we really want. So the ultimate solution is for all of us to vote for only candidates who co-sponsor S-604 and the Vitter amendments in the Senate, or H.R. 3833, which is the Federal Reserve Abolition Act, in the House. And then also a quick question is, would you, your guest, be interested in writing a film screenplay for this story, starting, say, in late 1910 with the creation of the Federal Reserve and bringing it up to present?
Sure. Answer to the question, sure. And for the clarification, thank you. I wasn't aware of that.
You're welcome.
I appreciate the clarification.
Sure.
Thanks, Andy. Are you in the movie biz? You're in the L.A.?
No, I'm not, but I'm in the Liberty Movement, and I'm one of the soldiers in the fight.
All right. Appreciate the call. East of the Rockies, George in Manhattan. Good morning, George.
Good morning, gentlemen. Mr. Farrell, I'm thinking Memorial Day is a week away,
mm-hmm.
and you remind me of the leap of faith that George Washington had when he crossed the Delaware.
Mm-hmm.
And do you believe the leap of faith that he took, and it was obviously in something that worked out very, very well for the first 50 or 100 years of this country. But if we can get back to the Constitution, I think that's going to be part of the solution.
Well, I appreciate the question, George. The short answer is yes, I do believe in that, for this very simple reason that we have been operating for so long under what can only be described as a non-constitutional or unconstitutional form of money. So getting back to it is certainly not going to hurt, and the Founding Fathers were certainly wise in understanding, particularly Thomas Jefferson, understanding the role of the private money power in corrupting states. So absolutely, I believe in it.
Thanks, George. West of the Rockies, Brandon in Santa Cruz. Hi, Brandon.
Hi, gentlemen. I only started listening about an hour ago, but I was very intrigued by what I heard. It's such a potpourri of subjects. And Joseph, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on William Bramley and his book, The Gods of Eden. I've read that book a while back, and a lot of the subject matter that you've touched on, he dealt with. You know, being that you know, going back to the history of the world, and you know, different cabals and and whatnot. Basically, I wanted to ask. He's never been on Coast to Coast. I don't know if he's still with us. But are you familiar with him at all?
Yeah, in fact, I've read his book. I've got it in my library. But I don't really, to answer kind of the implied question, Brandon, I really don't get into the gods aspect of it in Babylon's Banksters. All I really do in that book, as far as the ancient history part of it goes, is I go into the connection of this alliance between the temple and the money-creating power at that time, and then the odd fact that it is always coordinated or correlated with their astrological activity and with the possibility that some of these temples actually represent a kind of very, very primitive radio-transmitting technology. And I rely on that for that on the work of a German engineer that's published this book in Germany. So that's kind of the short answer to your question, but I am aware of his work.
That's a great book, and you know, one of the themes he developed in that book is, you know, you look at history and it always seems there's somebody there to manipulate events, to cause calamities or exploit them, to generate wars, things of that sort. I imagine that crosses paths with some of the folks you're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely it does.
Thanks, Brandon. Appreciate it. First-time caller Lisa in Cincinnati. Hi, Lisa.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think your series, your program, and the segment is incredible. And I just have a very quick question for Mr. Farrell. In America now, I wanted to know, based on human life, because of the corruption and the greed of the banksters, what is the cost to the poor and to the middle class in the sense of destroyed lives, suicide, just all of the really bad negative ramifications of all of this greed?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, Lisa. I really don't think that we can put a price on the human suffering that it has caused. We all probably know someone or have friends that know someone that has been affected by it, that's lost their homes, that have been put into massive debt and so on and so forth by this easy credit philosophy that these companies have extended. And they're, to be quite blunt, they're usurious rates of interest and fees, which I think are just beyond any ethical pale whatsoever. I myself don't have a credit card. I refuse to get one because I just think it's approaching the point of criminality. But yes, there are people that are suffering, and it's high time, like I say at the very end of the book, it's high time to have done with these banksters.
Great question, Lisa. You know, Joseph, a lot of folks hope that we're going to bounce back, that all these jobs that were lost, these millions of jobs, will somehow be regenerated. Mm-hmm. Do you get the feeling that we're never going to get those back, that they're gone for good?
No, I do think we'll get them back when we wake up and realize that we cannot have a real functioning economy without a manufacturing base. I mean, my word, you look at China, you look at Russia, you look at Germany, all of these countries have managed to maintain some sort of hold over their manufacturing base. I just don't see that we're going to get back to anything until we make real jobs available to people making things rather than flipping hamburgers. This service economy idea didn't work for Spain during the days of its empire, and it's not going to work for us either.
I mentioned it in the introduction to this program, is that, you know, America used to make stuff. Now what we make is deals.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, and that's very aptly put. I couldn't agree more.
Thanks for the call. Wildcard line, Chris in Antioch, California. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, good morning. Good morning. Thanks, guys. You're doing the life's work there. Hey, I had a question. I think it's the Holy Roman Empire is still, you know, reassessed and running things via us. And I wanted to see if you recognize that we're a Roman state, you know, based on all our systems here. And also, I wanted to see if there's a limit to how much we can take before the curtain drops. I mean, how much of a presentation can the citizens take before they, you know, we just give up all the creme de vie and sink in and do the old style thing like our, you know, the predecessors. And then furthermore, you know, just real quick, these are just comments, you know, you can address them or not. But I wanted to see if anyone could prove if the Civil War ever ended in this country, because, you know, it's split off into the continent north and the industrial south. And, you know, and I think those are the politicians today. They all eat at the same table, but it's just the north and south, just like it was back then. And then that goes to the Kennedy thing. That is how I found out the north and south, you know, just on a personal issue, a note there is the Kennedy. I've seen that Oswald's bullet hit that sidewalk, and the guy over there, you know, there's a French guy shot the, he got footage from across the street from the original footage, and they show the guy there. But regardless of that, you know, that's where the bullet came from, in the knoll somewhere around there, obviously. But the real bullet came from the building next door to the bookstore depository.
Hey, Chris, we're getting a little off the, we're getting sort of a little off the topic. Let me let Joseph sort of tackle the first part of your observations there, and then we'll come back to Kennedy.
Well, Chris, I think in a certain sense it's somewhat of a misnomer to look at America as being a kind of a continuation of Rome. Certainly our symbols, you know, the fasces that are in the House of Representatives and so on and so forth, some of those things are clearly Roman in origin. But in terms of our jurisprudence, that is all Anglo-Saxon, thank goodness, because, you know, there are certain protections in that law that do not exist under Roman law. So I think we have to get back to our Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence, and the first step would be to restore constitutional money. As far as the North-South thing goes, I think really in the case of the modern United States and Canada, you're looking more at more than just two regions. You're looking at the Northeast, you're looking at the Old South, you're looking at Texas, the American Southwest, the Northwest, and where I'm at in the Upper Plains. And each of those regions has had in the last few decades very, very disparate emerging economic and cultural interests. There is a clear, palpable difference in culture here where I live in South Dakota than say, in California or the Northeast. And it shows in the different values of people here. So I think America is being regionalized to a certain extent, in spite of the best efforts of these banksters to create a kind of a conglomerate entity. That's what I think is going on. And in fact, there was even a Russian KGB study to that effect that was done years ago in the late 1970s and early 80s that predicted very much the same thing would happen. So that would be my response to your questions.
Okay, I don't think you want to jump into the bullet and where it came from on JFK, do you? Okay, thanks for the call, Chris. Appreciate it. Frank in Carlsbad, California, on the Wild Card Line. Hi, Frank. What's on your mind?
Hi, great show. You had a comment in the first half hour, Doctor, about silver was used in Asia as a metal, a monetary metal. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, are the central bankers involved in suppressing the price of silver? Because traditionally, silver has traded from between 10 to 1 to maybe 15 or 16 to 1 in terms of the gold price. And right now we're sitting up at 70 to 1.
Yes.
So do you believe the central banks are suppressing the price of silver? That's my first question. I'll take my answer off here. The other question I have, would we really be better off if the Treasury printed the money instead of the Federal Reserve? They could inflate the currency just like the Fed. So, but mainly my question is silver. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Frank.
That's an excellent question, Frank, and I do get into the second half of it. I think, yes, we would be better off than under the Federal Reserve, because in point of fact, when you look at all the hyperinflations in recent history, they have been the cause of the banksters, not the cause of the governments. Governments would have a vested interest, if they were genuinely responsive to the people, by issuing state-issued money. They would have a vested interest not to inflate the currency, and in fact, If you go back to the pre-revolutionary days in colonial America, when the colonies were doing precisely that, inflation was not a problem. It became a problem after we had the institution of private monopoly bank-issued money. So the historical record is exactly the opposite of what you would think and what the bankers want you to believe. And I forget the first part of that question, the silver, the
whether the banksters had something to do with suppressing the price of silver.
Yeah, I think, again, just based on what I researched in Babylon's banksters, the answer has to be yes, because they do have a vested interest in gold mining and so on and so forth, and in keeping gold prices artificially high. So my short answer would be yes.
Going to Sandra in Cincinnati on the east of the Rockies line. Hi, Sandra.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question, and I would like to know, why is it that there are so many people from India that are buying up most of the motels, most of the little places where you can, like, you know, like the fast food, like you walk in and you buy a sandwich and you get gas, like gas stations. Mm-hmm. But yet the American people, they go to the bank and they can't get a loan. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, even in the small towns when I drive through them, I mean, here are these people, you run in to get gas, and they're from India, okay? And then you go to a motel or a hotel, and then all up and down the expressway, they're all from India. Mm-hmm. So I would like to know if you have any input on this, and maybe, and then I can just hang up and you can take my answer offline. Thank you for taking my call.
Okay, anything sinister there, Dr. Farrell?
Well, Sandra, my guess is if we're looking at a deliberate policy, then it's of a piece with the larger agenda that they've had over the past decades in trying to overturn or sink America with a kind of a multicultural agenda. And please don't get me wrong here. I'm not against people having their own culture. But the fact of the matter is that this country is founded on a certain cultural basis and only functions well when it's functioning on that basis. So if there's an agenda involved, my guess would be it's part of the credit policies of these corporations trying to maintain or sustain that global homogenization that they've been after in this country.
Joseph, you've sort of touched on the Masonic world a couple of times. Is there a connection or is it just correlation?
Oh, no, there's definitely a connection. Masonry is, particularly in England, it is so infused and suffused throughout the structures of power in that country, and certainly in the American Northeast it has been for quite some time as well. But even more importantly, you have the quasi-Masonic trappings and initiations of some of the orders, like Skull and Bones and some of the fraternal societies at Yale and Harvard. So, yes, it is definitely part of the power structure, although I would also add as a caveat to that, that most Masons, in my opinion, are really very, very innocent of any of that activity. I think you have to go to the very, very high reaches of some of those fraternities before you are really involved in anything sinister. Most Masons are simply unaware of it.
I guess when you talk about a combination of finance and religion, which is a theme in your book, the Vatican would come to mind, and maybe we'll get into that and take more calls when we come back here on Coast to Coast AM. Stay with us. Our final segment with my guest, Joseph Farrell, his book, Babylon's Banksters. We're going to the phones, and we'll get to as many of your calls as we can right after these messages on Coast to Coast AM. Our final segment with Joseph Farrell. We're going to the phones east of the Rockies, Dennis in St. Louis. Good morning, Dennis.
Oh, good morning. I got a two-part question. Number one would be, what type of precedent did George Washington set when he used troops to enforce the collection of taxes? And number two would be, would it be better if the states went back to issuing their own monies?
Oh, boy. I think, no. First of all, I don't think it would be a good idea for states to go back to issuing their own monies. However, there is a phenomenon that has been happening in this country and other countries as a result of this financial collapse, and that is the idea of so-called community currencies. There's a famous example of that in this country called Ithaca Ours. And I think you're going to see more and more of that sort of thing taking place as people find practical solutions to their local economic problems. So I think in the short term that's a good idea, but in the long term, if we're going to carry on and conduct commerce at a national and international level, I think that the United States has to get back to the idea of constitutional money. Now, the idea of troops to collect taxes, I think, you know, giving all due deference to the first president, I think that's a very bad precedent to set.
Hey, we've got the IRS now. We don't need troops. Thanks, Dennis.
That's right.
West of the Rockies, Kenny in Mill Valley. Hi, Kenny.
Hi there. Just curious. I heard part of what you said about John Kennedy and when he was involved in changing the banking system. And I'm a professional astrologer. I've been at it for 40 years now. Uh-huh. And I know John Kennedy's chart, and he's got five planets in the eighth house of bankier. Of bankers and money from other people. So I could see how he had some interest in that subject. Uh-huh. And it would be, there are a lot of afflictions to his eighth house, which also indicated his tragic death. But it was, I'm just curious if you knew enough about astrology to know anything about John Kennedy's chart before you mentioned his problem when he tried to change the banking right. in this country.
Well, the short answer is no. I don't know anything about his personal chart. I find it very interesting that you bring that up. It doesn't really surprise me. Most of what I put in Babylon's Banksters is basically the chart of the United States, the mundane horoscope, and that's pretty much where I stuck. I'm really not a professional astrologer. I relied on other people's research for that part of the book, but that's very interesting to me. So thank you for sharing that. It doesn't surprise me.
Thanks, Kenny. Tell me this. We were talking about presidents who may have been assassinated by these guys. Was it the bankers that tried to take out Andrew Jackson?
Oh, yes. They made several attempts on Jackson because Jackson, of course, was the president that not only went after the bankers, but he was successful in actually de-chartering or not renewing the charter of the Federal Reserve of his day, which was called the Bank of the United States. And he actually had some pretty direct words to say about the bankers.
And they tried to get him and failed?
Oh, yes. They tried to get him, I think it was a couple of times, actually, and failed both times. Yeah. Yeah.
First-time caller, Brad in downtown L.A. Hi, Brad.
Hi, George and Joseph. I have two things. One's a little bit about Kennedy, and the other one is about the Federal Reserve.
Uh-huh.
There's a book called The Federal Reserve, Its Purposes and Functions.
Uh-huh.
And the Federal Reserve banks published that, and there's a chart in there where they give away their secrets. Under the Federal Reserve Act, they're able to buy a note for a penny apiece.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And they're supposed to give their profits to the U.S. Treasury under the Federal Reserve Act.
Mm-hmm.
But instead of doing that, they put in their chart, which is in the book, they published it, instead of showing that it cost them a penny for the $100 bill, and have a $99.99 profit, it shows that they paid $100 for it when they didn't. That's what Ron Paul is trying to prove
yes.
with his audit.
Yes, yes. I would totally agree with that. Yes, absolutely.
The purposes and functions of the Reserve, it shows the chart right there.
Yep.
It's in the book. They're so blatant about it that they just published it.
Doesn't surprise.
The other thing is about Kennedy. Kennedy issued an executive order around August or September of the year he was killed. And in that executive order, he issued silver certificates in denominations of $1, $5, and $10 and U.S. notes with the red seal on them.
Mm-hmm.
In similar denominations.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was killed in November.
Yes.
So that's pretty quick. One of the first things that Johnson did after he became president was to repeal or reverse that executive order.
Yes, that's right. That's correct.
Then the Federal Reserve took all of the $100 notes. They put those red seal notes into $100 bills, and they withdrew them from the system, and they hide them.
Yes.
And they did that in 1966.
Well, that's an old tactic of the banksters when they are faced with a state that is going back to state-issued money. You find the same thing going on in ancient times, and I talk even a bit about the famous Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta, because Sparta was one of those city-states that did not want to fall under the power of the bankers of their day and issue debt money. So this is an old practice that they have in removing any of that type of money from circulation and maintaining only their own money in circulation. That's an old tactic.
Thanks, Brad. Appreciate the call. On our Skype line, Dean in Ohio. Hi, Dean.
Yeah, hi. How you doing? Great show tonight. My first question was for Mr. Farrell, and I was wondering if about the Knight Templars, whether he might have ever considered that that was actually to eliminate the competition and as they were bankers too.
Well, in a certain sense, yes, I think it probably was. But the real motivation for Philippe Lebel was that his government was basically broke. And what he was hoping to do, I think the standard line here is fairly true. I think what he was hoping to do was lay his hand on all the treasure that he thought was in the Templar vaults. And the Templars, if you study it carefully enough, it's very clear that they had removed and had anticipated most of his action and removed their wealth and transported it elsewhere outside of France. So they had somebody, in other words, on the inside that tipped them off.
Thanks, Dean. Appreciate it. Pete on our wildcard line calling from Cleveland. Good morning, Pete. Pete's gone. Thomas in Florida, how you doing?
Hello.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Very fascinating show.
Thanks.
Question of the global trust and the banksters and busting. The manipulation of the masses.
Mm-hmm.
First, it requires constitutionally or justice, domestic tranquility, and common defense. That's what we're provided with, the citizens of this country. We have the best forlorn rights. How can we protect ourselves against being persuaded of tyranny that's coming upon us, whether it be globally, financially? We're being ripped off, the Chinese. We've bought more things from China that aren't worth, well, we make money and pay them. Or may I ask this, the old question of, we'll sell you the rope to hang you with.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas, it's a good question. I think there are two steps that we have to take. Number one, we have to inform ourselves. We have to know what the real difference between real money is and what I call the facsimile of money or monetized debt, which is issued by a private bank. That's the first step. We have to know that difference. We have to understand the fact that our founding fathers wanted the state to issue money, not a private monopoly. We have to get back to that system. So the second step is to inform yourself of the politicians that are calling for that, to support them, and to spread the word far and wide to as many people as you can. Those are the two steps that we, you know, personally as individuals can take in all of this. And if you're the writing sort, write about it. You know, publish a newsletter, circulate things, get the ideas out there and in circulating in the population, and it will turn around.
Thanks, Thomas. Christopher in Pueblo, Colorado. Hi, Christopher.
Yes. With the decentralization of money, taking it to the state issued,
mm-hmm.
would that render it constitutional money?
Well, I think you're confused by what I mean by state. When I say state, I don't mean the individual 50 states in the United States. I mean the federal government itself. In other words, the U.S. Treasury actively and immediately do it.
What is constitutional money?
Constitutional money is simply money issued by the state. The Constitution says the Congress shall have the power to make and coin money. In other words, it is a right and prerogative of a sovereign nation to issue its own money. They did not envision that it would be turned over to a private banking monopoly. And again, the reason why is a bank can only lend money into circulation. It cannot issue money into circulation. Only governments can do that. When a bank lends money into circulation, all it creates is the principal. It never creates the interest. So by definition, if you have a central bank issuing the money of the state, what it's doing is lending the state the money, and the interest can only grow. You will never have a balanced budget under that system. The only time that the United States has had a balanced budget was precisely under, guess who, President Andrew Jackson. And what did he do? He got rid of the central bank.
Chris, thank you for the call. Are there is there equivalents of the Federal Reserve in other countries?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The Bank of England is the same sort of institution. Back in the day, the Reichsbank was in Germany. Most of the nations that we're familiar with in Europe have a private central bank that's behind the issuance of their currency. The only modern powerful nation that really issues its own currency debt-free is, again, Communist China.
Wildcard line, Will in Madison, Wisconsin. Good morning, Will.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. There is a kind of an interesting blog. If they kindly go to Google and type FINNICS and the number 7, Phoenix 7. Mm-hmm. I have a question. A little red news item appeared recently that the interest on U.S. Treasury securities will be paid by U.S. government, and this will prevent the gold price to continue rising. My question is, what is your take on that? And two, do we not have a soft underbelly, just like Russia does, a soft underbelly, namely with the Mexican drug mafias coming into America? Here in Madison, Wisconsin, for example, two drug mafias have fought each other just recently. Never has happened in nice city of Madison before. America is dying. A nation cannot stand if its timbers are being eaten. How do you respond?
Thanks, Will. Interesting point about narco dollars.
Yes, that is a whole can of worms that I did not touch in Babylon's Banksters, because the whole subject of the enormity of the illegal drug trade in the world is itself a subject in itself. There was a researcher a few years back by the name of Mike Rupert that kind of specialized in that. But yes, I agree that this is something also that we have to address. The interesting thing about that whole trade is, if you look back in history to the early 1800s in this country, you find many of the wealthy families in this country, the old wealth, involved precisely in the drug trade. So it's another problem we're going to have to address. But I think the first thing we have to do is cut the head of corruption off right where it is, and at least pass these bills to audit the Federal Reserve and then take it from there.
Is there cooperation, you think, at some level between these narco cartels and the banksters?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, they're obvious, you know, they hide their money in banks and things of that sort, but is there cooperation on another sort of level?
Yes, I think there is, and I think the principal thing in evidence for that, and again, I do not talk about this in Babylon's Banksters, but the whole, if you remember the BCCI scandal, the Bank of Credit and Commerce International, which was just, you know, the epithet was it was the Bank of Crooks and Criminals International, which, as it turned out, was basically what it was. But yes, I think that one episode was just the tip of the iceberg at some sort of deeper underlying cooperation.
Okay, east of the Rockies, Marilyn in North Carolina. Hi, Marilyn.
Hi, Mr. Farrell. Why has nobody gotten a team? You mentioned a little while ago that there were mathematicians brought in way back when, mm-hmm. modeling stuff, and would mm-hmm. you agree that software is modeled and implemented on stuff that people have uncovered, like these people, or set in stone? And why can't we get a team of expert software test people, super thinkers, analysts, systems people, mm-hmm. and start looking into this and uncovering? You would be amazed at what we can find. Why has that not even been attempted? And you could never imagine the amount of doctoring, so to speak, as you mentioned, that's been coded into the system. It can be uncovered. It's not exactly rocket science. It can be done.
Well, I would agree. That would... and in fact, that's probably a good thing that needs to be done. But, you know, as far as I know, no one has put that out there on, as an agenda or something to be considered. But as far as the physicists entering the banking industry, it basically was kind of an accident because there were so many graduates that were not able to find work in physics, and they took their mathematical, their applied mathematical skills, and they went to work for these large banks, and as it turned out, made probably more money doing that than they ever would have as a scientist. It was something that was more or less tailor-made for them. So it's not surprising to see that, that these banks have had the kind of models evolve that they've had evolve.
Thanks for the call, Marilyn. Is she is the implication there that maybe there's some sort of an ex officio audit that could be undertaken?
I think so. I think so. And again, I think, you know, if this Federal Reserve audit passes and if it's actually done, they're probably going to uncover things like that in the process of the audit if, in fact, they're able to get their hands on genuine records.
All right. Try to get one more call in. Sure. West of the Rockies, Dave in Washington. Good morning, Dave.
Good morning. Say, you know, all this stuff that's been said tonight, you've got great insight on stuff, but one thing that's always been failed or has failed over the years, and that is because government, through the corporate, well, it's actually a corporate government because we switched that from FDR, we aren't really constitutional. It's all non-constitutional because if you go to court and fight the IRS, you fight them with the, try to say, I come in under the Constitution. No, it's non-constitutional as far as the game goes. And because you've got a Social Security number, because everyone back from the days was FDR, that created the whole thing where you became a slave, an economic slave, and they need your bodies to pay their debt. And so by not having that, of course, taught in school, because obviously the publishers and all that are through the banksters and what they own to keep that stuff dumbed down so that people do not know what's going on.
Right, right.
And so with the loss of that education until people wake up, you know, they're going to be just stuck in the same rut for the rest of their lives. And just a certain few will try to get themselves out of that slavery gap. But, you know, it's just like the minority that ran or got the Constitution in place. It wasn't a majority. It was a minority.
Hey, Dave, we got about a minute left in the program. Anyways, Joseph, you want to tackle that?
Well, very quickly,
actually, we got about 30 seconds.
Very quickly, I think people are waking up, and I think that's why you're seeing all these bills in Congress. I think the tide has turned.
Joseph Farrell, author of Babylon's Banksters, thanks very much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you, George. Yes, it's been fun.
We'll have you back another time, and I'll be back Friday night with a night of open lines. Hope you can join me then. Good night, everyone.